Ahead of the White House Conference on Aging, Tampa hosted the only regional forum in the entire Southeast. We take a look at some of the issues facing seniors. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Kirsten Cooper. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Medicare, Medicaid, and the Older Americans Act, as well as the 80th anniversary of Social Security. Since the 1960s, the White House has held a conference on aging aimed at finding new ways to improve the lives of older Americans. The next conference will be in Washington, D.C. on July 13th. Regional forums have been taking place around the nation in recent months, and one of them was in Tampa. We're bringing you highlights of the discussion that took place at Hillsborough Community College in Ybor City. The panel was moderated by AARP's Executive Vice President Nancy Lamond.
Older people, as we know, as all of you know, are targets for fraud and abuse. Millions are affected by elder abuse and neglect every single year. One out of every 10 people age 60 and over who live at home suffer abuse, neglect, or exploitation. Now, the good news is there is strong interest on the parts of individuals and families to know how to protect themselves. As Janine English, our volunteer president, said, we at AARP have launched a Fraud Watch network, and in a very short period of time, we have 500,000 people who have signed up and are able to get daily alerts just to be prepared for that that phone call or that email that comes. We also know that there are efforts across the country to close gaps in state law to help create a uniform system so family caregivers can care for their family members across state lines and protect them from abuse. The second topic we're going to discuss today is well documented, the retirement gap in this country. We know that Social Security is the bedrock of retirement in this country, and that nearly half of our citizens today rely on it for their pretty much their only source of income in retirement. In addition, we know that those who are saving for retirement through various vehicles they have in the workplace are probably not putting away quite as much as they're going to need, especially with caregiving and long-term care. We know that the amount of money that would be needed is even greater than some people think. And then, of course, 55 million workers in this country do not have access to retirement savings in their workplace. So the bottom line is these are tough issues, but there are solutions, and we're going to hear a lot about that from this panel. First, we have Rebecca Becky Morgan. She is the Boston Asset Management Faculty Chair in Elder Law and the Director of the Center for Excellence in Elder Law at Stetson University College of Law. She teaches a variety of courses to law students. In addition to being a law professor and an expert, she's a leader in the nonprofit community. She is the past president of the National Academy of Elder Lawyer Attorneys, and the past president of the board of directors of the National Senior Citizens Law Center.
It's great to be here. It's quite an honor. As Nancy said, I teach elder law to law students, so I'm trying to educate future lawyers on the issues facing elders in the United States. And also because I've held leadership positions in national organizations such as the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, I've had the opportunity to look at the issues both at a national level in addition to the level that I've seen in Florida locally and statewide. I'm going to give you just a brief overview of some of the issues revolving around elder abuse that I think bear thinking and discussing, and then perhaps some ways to be moving forward in a big picture way. So I think the first thing we all want to think about is what we mean when we say elder abuse. It's really become an umbrella phrase that we refer to use in terms of different specific types of elder abuse. So we're thinking about whether we're looking at abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. And within that, different things happen that come out to be a type of elder abuse. And so with abuse, we may have somebody who's been physically abused, psychologically abused, sexually abused. Neglect, there's a caregiver with the duty to take care of the elder and has breached that duty. And with financial exploitation, taking your money or your property, oftentimes I have heard explanations, people who have been accused of financial exploitation, they say, well, I was going to get it anyway. And it always astounds me that there's that kind of thinking out there. We have statutes in all 50 states that address elder abuse, but one of the things we have to think about is not all the definitions in the states are identical. And so I think it would be incredibly helpful to us if we had uniformity within our definitions. The other thing we need to think about is prevalence, how much elder abuse actually occurs. And for various reasons, we don't really know the exact number. We do know that many cases don't get reported and some cases don't even get detected. And this is a significant issue. And how we get more people to report elder abuse is something that we've been discussing for a long time and something I think we have to continue to discuss. The Department of Justice has a new website. They have an Elder Initiative website, and I hope you look at it. As Nancy mentioned, 1 in 10 Americans 60 and over 60 are victims of abuse every year. And when you add us baby boomers to the mix, think about how many more people we're talking about that are going to be victims of elder abuse. Whether it is abuse, neglect, or exploitation, the impact on victims and on society is profound. It cannot be underestimated. The MetLife did a study of financial elder abuse that was released in 2011. And they did an estimate of the amount of financial loss by victims to be $2.9 billion. Can we prevent elder abuse? How do we respond to cases of elder abuse? Prevention and responses, long time topic, one we have to continue to talk about. There are good developments happening of late, and I think it's very heartening to see what's going on. We've got to focus on education, prevention, and response. And so we need to think about whether mandatory reporting statutes are effective, who's covered by them. Is there better ways to deal with it? State statutes do vary about whether reporting is required and who's covered by it. We also, because I'm a lawyer, I have to say this, we also need to look at the legal remedies, both civil and criminal, and see whether they're sufficient, because we may need to tighten up how we go about responding. We also need to think about all the agencies that are involved and that address elder abuse and recognize that at least at a local level, we may have more than one agency working a case. For example, if you have a victim of neglect, we may have APS providing services to the individual and the prosecutor may be looking at filing criminal charges. We want to make sure that we have mechanisms in place so that all the agencies that are working can work together and that we can get the information we need. We want to make sure that we recognize, and I know this is going to be one of those things that's hard to deal with, but is there adequate funding? Sometimes it seems that it comes down to money, but we've got to make sure that the state budgets are allocating sufficient resources for agencies to do their work. Now, as far as at the federal level, there's been some really long-standing things going on that have been important, such as the Older Americans Act, and you know, Title VII, the Social Services Block Grants, the Title III Legal Services. As I mentioned earlier, the Department of Justice is now working on this issue, and their Elder Justice Initiative is terrific. It's got resources for victims and families, researchers, and importantly for prosecutors and attorneys. So if you haven't done so, check out the website. You don't have to do it right now, but make a point of checking out that website. Now, I think the Elder Justice Act is the most significant thing that has occurred in the fight in elder abuse that I've seen. I was so excited when it finally passed. It's part of the Affordable Care Act. And initially, it didn't get a lot of money, but it's getting more money, and I believe that with continued leadership, it's going to get additional funding. And that, I think, is terrific. One other thing I want to think about with you is the fact that elder abuse can happen to anyone. I hope all of you saw Mickey Rooney's testimony before the Senate Select Committee on Aging. And I hope you remember what he said. Mickey Rooney, so very famous, said, "If it could happen to me, it can happen to anyone." So it could be Mickey Rooney, it could be Brooke Astor, or it could be your neighbor. You don't have to be famous to be a victim of elder abuse. The bottom line, I think, is to remember that it could happen to anyone. Now, I think we want to think about consumer scams and frauds and how this ties in. For those of you who get email, how many of you have ever gotten an offer to, get hired for something for someone you don't know, or perhaps if you would only give your bank account number, this person in another country is going to put millions in your account for you? It happens to all of us, and we have to think about how we're going to be more effective in fighting consumer scams and frauds. The Internal Revenue Service, the U.S. Postal Service, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Social Security, lots of different federal agencies working together to deal with these particular issues. It's so exciting to see that this White House Conference on Aging has as one of its four priorities elder justice. We've done it before, we're doing it again. It's a positive and important step, and I hope that we're able to achieve coordinated and an increased response to the growing problem of elder abuse. I want to commend the administration for doing this, and I want to thank everybody for the opportunity to be part of this and for you all to be part of the solution.
We have Patty Dukaya, the long-term care ombudsman for the state of Texas. As you can imagine, Texas is a big place, and there she works in an agency that licenses and regulates Texas's nearly 1,200 nursing facilities. Working there, she has championed moving the culture from one that focuses on the individual rather than the institution. Delighted to have her here today as well.
Good morning again. I am the state long-term care ombudsman in Texas, and I also represent the National Association of State Long-Term Care Ombudsman Programs. I serve as president. And it's a great honor to represent long-term care ombudsman today and to talk about how we play a role in elder justice. Long-term care ombudsmen are authorized by the Older Americans Act. We serve as an advocate for people who live in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. We represent their interests in individual complaints that we work, but we also serve as a public advocate and speak on the collective interests of residents who live in long-term care facilities. Being an advocate is a privilege and it's a responsibility. There are almost 1.4 million people living in nursing homes and over 700,000 people living in assisted living nationwide. Ombudsmen are in regular contact with nursing home residents and with a lot of assisted living facility residents too. Our presence with them helps protect their rights, promote their self-determination. We promote empowerment and we try to reduce the impact of powerlessness that can come from poor care, abuse, and neglect. We are celebrating in the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program because for the first time, we have federal regulations to guide our work. The regulations do a lot for us and explain a lot about the Older Americans Act, but two things I wanted to point out to you, that it gives us guidance as ombudsmen about how we can help and work with people with dementia, someone who can't consent to our help normally. And it's so important that the Act recognize that we need to help all people regardless of their disease or incapacity. The other guidance that it gives is clear instruction about how an ombudsman should respond to abuse reporting, investigation, and resolution. If you put the description of a long-term care ombudsman into a little filter, you get the cloud of the image that I've shared with you on the screen. And what I love about this is that the visual puts residents at the center. And resident is the terminology that an ombudsman uses to describe the people who live in these settings where we work and advocate. And putting residents in the middle of our work and keeping them centered is so important. And it's such a good visual for what ombudsmen are all about. I wanted to share a quick story with you about elder justice in action. And it starts with a form. An adult child brings a form to her mother and asks her to sign it. And this form gives authority to the child in the case of the person losing her capacity to make her own decisions, both financially and medical decisions. Then the child goes to her mother's doctor, tells the doctor about how mom has left the stove on and burned food. She's not paying bills. And really kind of sight unseen, the physician writes a letter that states the mom has lost her memory, and poof, that form takes effect. So armed with the power of attorney and the doctor's note, the mom is brought to a locked facility and admitted. She's tricked to get in there. What is a locked facility like? Well, this one had requirements that mom can't go outside without somebody alongside with her. She's living with people who have memory problems, confusion, and she really can't interact with any of the residents. When she tells her story to staff about the problems she's encountered, they think she's crafted this story to explain her world of dementia. Only she doesn't have dementia. So a few weeks later, an ombudsman walks in, wearing a badge, and she beelines it for the ombudsman, tells her story. We listen and we believe her. We get her permission, we look at records, we talk to family, we talk to staff. And the outcome is she got her freedom back. Returning back to her home, getting services in her home, she just needed a little help a few hours a week. But we helped her restore her rights. What would have happened if the ombudsman hadn't walked in, if we hadn't listened, if she, the resident, hadn't been able to direct us in what she needed and what was the outcome she wanted to see? How long would her rights have been removed? How many other rights would have been lost? What kind of damage would have been done to her mental health or her bank account? I don't know. My story was about an ombudsman kind of working independently there, but we often need to rely on these important partners in elder justice, and I name them here for you: law enforcement, like police, district attorneys and victim services, adult protective services. Now, states fund their adult protective services, and that funding and what the services are like really varies based on funding. But a good adult protective services system values the adult as an adult, helps the person have as much independence as possible, even in the protective services situation. Long-term care ombudsman will keep efforts person-centered and serve as an advocate for the person. Facility surveyors. These are state officials that work to determine compliance with state and federal regulations that apply to facilities like a nursing home and also agencies like home health. For a good elder and legal help, we all need legal help to make this work. APS, ombudsmen, surveyors, and the police, they turn to legal counsel to pursue elder justice. And older Americans themselves need attorneys to help them navigate problems like their landlord evicting them, or a family member abusing power, or a financial scam. We all need to work together to get there.
Coming up,
not only did she not even understand where all of the paperwork was at in order to be self-sufficient, but she actually called me and said, could you tell me where the gas tank is located to put gas in the car? My husband always did this.
We'll hear more from the Regional Forum on Aging that took place at Hillsborough Community College in Ybor City. Ideas presented at these forums will be used at the White House Conference on Aging next month to develop new policies to protect seniors from fraud, abuse, and neglect. I'm Kirsten Cooper. This is Florida Matters. I'm Kirsten Cooper. This is Florida Matters. The next White House Conference on Aging, which is aimed at finding new ways to improve the lives of older Americans, will take place July 13th in Washington, D.C. Ahead of that conference, regional forums were held in Boston, Phoenix, Seattle, Cleveland, and Tampa. The discussion at Hillsborough Community College in Ybor City was the only regional forum held in the entire Southeast. We are bringing you highlights of that discussion, which was moderated by AARP's Executive Vice President, Nancy Lamond.
Vicki Alisa is the president of Mothers Voices of Georgia. This is a nonprofit organization in Atlanta that runs a program to help low-income women earning less than $30,000 a year become financially empowered.
Thank you very much. It's indeed a pleasure to be here today. And as shared by the panel members, this is a passion. I have been doing this for the last 20 years as a volunteer, and it's also personal. About 25 years ago, I faced a very traumatizing divorce, and I didn't know that I could negotiate the debt in that divorce. Instead, I ended up taking a little over $25,000 in debt that I needed to eradicate. I did it by having three jobs and working for 7 years. And I remembered hearing on that seventh year that James Brown was the hardest working man in showbiz. And I said, Brother James, we have a lot in common. That resonated with me because I knew that there were a lot of women. And as Nancy shared with you, there are quite a few women who are facing the same exact thing. And why women? Why is it important that we reach out to women with healthy retirement education? At the age of 65, there are 6 million more women than men. We know that 71% of the women who are 85 and older often live in poverty and live alone. These are the grandmothers, the sisters, the aunts, the cousin. These are the women who knit the very fabric of our society. They are there for us, but oftentimes, and we have a lot of quilting that happens in my family, when any of those threads are not strong enough, then that fabric or that quilt will not hold together. And when we talk about women in multi-ethnic populations, planning for a secure retirement is even more difficult. There are some very unique challenges that face women, especially those who are part of caregiving. I want to share with you some of the unique issues that impact women, and then talk about some viable solutions that we've learned in terms of education and reaching out to various community groups. First of all, we know that women live longer, and so that is a challenge. Panel members have talked about how do we prepare for a healthy retirement and ensure that women don't outlive what they need to successfully retire. I know the women in my family, I have one aunt, she just turned 103. And she still goes out and garden. Now, while that's a wonderful thing, I began to think about, wow, longevity prevails. I had another woman who came to me and told me that at the age of 82, her aunt was married for the first time. She had 12 bridesmaids, so there's still hope. Hear these wonderful stories. Also, we know that women earn less for every dollar, and this is all very well known to everyone, but I do often look at this data, and when I share it with women in community group settings, they're only hearing it for the very first time. For every dollar earned by a man, it's 78 cents earned by a woman. We also know that when it comes to savings and being able to be offered a pension, right now, only one-third of women who are working are even provided an opportunity to have a pension on the job. We also know that that's currently right now. And we also know that it is very difficult because of hardship issues for women to successfully save. But what we've learned in educating and reaching out to women in the community is that there are some life-defining moments that really help to emphasize the importance of healthy retirement planning. Often when I'm teaching in the community, because there's such a wealth of information out there, it's so important to be able to find something that resonates with women so that they can begin to take control of their destiny as it relates to planning for a successful retirement. I often ask the question, how many of you out there have born children and have experienced a pregnancy? And half the room will raise their hand. And I said, well, think about your retirement planning as a 35-year pregnancy. And I often hear about back from women as they're making decisions along the continuum, if you follow these basic steps, you will have a healthy retirement outcome. But it's hard work. You often may take a couple of steps backwards. But if you focus on what that goal is, your journey can be a lot more smoother in terms of securing your financial future. And so what can women do? Some of the lessons learned is that you can definitely start to save small. I know that I come from a very small rural family that my grandfather used to take the change out of his pocket at the end of the day and put it into a jar. And when you begin to talk about small concepts, things that resonate with women, that was something that a lot of women said, I remember my granddad or father doing that. And so often when it prevents me from having the additional income, my children, my house, my car, my health care needs. And so we talk about something as simple as that. That's something that women can grasp. Also, it's very important to know the rules of what's out there for the systems that support women, especially Social Security and workplace benefits. I'm often amazed that with the wealth of information out there, a lot of women don't even begin to think about planning for their retirement until sometimes 1 or 2 years before they are ready to retire. Another thing that often strikes me is divorce and widowhood. I recently came across a woman who told me not only did she lost her husband, but she told me not only did she not even understand where all of the paperwork was at in order to be self-sufficient, but she actually called me and said, could you tell me where the gas tank is located to put gas in the car? My husband always did this. And so it's very important to educate women and realize that there are different points of being able to get critical information across. Audience segmentation is also very critical. The use of trusted messengers, I think I heard earlier, hearing from women that sound and look at like the groups that you are trying to reach is so, so critical. And also creating an environment where women can share their stories and learn from each other is also important. And then there's also that opportunity to connect women with great information that is out there. There is a wealth of information that we like to direct women to. And I thank you so much for being able to share some of the real stories that are out there impacting the women who are trying to have a healthy retirement.
That's it for today's show. Florida Matters is produced by Lottie Watts with help from Mary Shedden and is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Kirsten Cooper. Thanks for listening.